The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Jamie Marisotis. Jamie is a globally recognized leader in philanthropy, higher education, and public policy. Since 2008, he has served as president and CEO of Lumina Foundation, one of the largest private foundations in the U.S. His writing has appeared in the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Washington Monthly, and Politico. He is the author of America Needs Talent, Attracting, Educating, and Deploying the 21st Century Workforce. Jamie Marisotis, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Kelly.
I had a former colleague at Second City who liked to rant and rave about the worth or non-worth of a college education. Mind you, this guy had a bachelor's degree from a very good school. But he was convinced that college had become overpriced and politically dysfunctional. And I agree that it costs too much because I'm paying that right now, and that access might be a problem. But my experience and the experience of my 20-year-old, who's a sophomore at Skidmore College in New York, is overwhelmingly positive in education.
Yeah, the reality is that there is this dichotomy. On the one hand, college, particularly four-year college, is too expensive. The price of college has increased faster than the rate of inflation for four decades.
Wow.
And so we are in this long-term pattern where it is very difficult to see a time period when people who would be what we would consider college age today would have lived in a world where college increased at less than the rate of inflation. We also have a trend, I think, where it is increasingly unclear what people are learning in college. In other words, that the transparency of what they're learning isn't as clear. On the other hand, if you look simply at the economic data, your chances of being a part of the middle class are diminishing, and they continue to diminish unless you get one of these college or post-secondary credentials. Could be a bachelor's degree, could be an associate degree, could even be a certificate or some other credential. But the point is that in the world that we now live in, the nature of work is such that it's a knowledge economy, and the tasks that people have to do in this knowledge economy require the combination of generalizable skills, critical thinking, problem solving, et cetera, and applied knowledge, the things that you need to know about something, chemistry or graphic design or something like that, in order to be successful. So it is hard to make the argument when somebody points to their cousin's brother or sister who is still working in a low-wage job, even though she graduated from college 3 years ago. But on net, the reality is that the vast majority of people who get a college degree make substantially more money. They have a higher quality of life, lots of surveys that show this to be true, and they are better participants in our democracy. And that is actually accelerating. The killer fact that I have tried to explain to people in the last couple of years is that we had this natural experiment during the post-recession period. So during the recession, which went from 2008 to 2010, the people getting jobs with people who had college degrees were continuing to get jobs, whereas everyone else was not getting jobs. Post-recession, what we saw was the labor market overwhelmingly shifting. And essentially what employers said was, if you don't have a college degree, we don't want to hire you. And the killer fact is that between 2011 and the middle of 2016, there were 11.5 million jobs created in the U.S. economy, new jobs. Of those 11.5 million, 11.4 million went to people with a college degree.
Wow. All right. So, and this is your point around this idea around talent, right? And when I do these, my show notes that when I do the podcast, I write a thing that's usually just for me, but it is like, what is talent? Because this is a thing that you talk about in the book. And I had Angela Duckworth on the podcast, and she wrote Grit, and you probably know her work.
Of course.
And she had big issues with me using the word talent because it implied a kind of otherness or specialness or magic. And I think you feel similarly to that. I mean, you're cool using the term, but that too often we think of talent as being, it's just they're innately talented. And that's kind of not, you're saying that that's not the case.
Yeah, you know, it's difficult to sort of change the language, but the fact is talent is a combination of both your innate ability and how you actually develop it through education, through experience, through your life. And so, you know, talent is what happens when knowledge, skills, and abilities are honed by things like education and experience in a way that changes the trajectory of your life and, by the way, changes all of our lives, because
right.
The collective impact of people with talent really makes a real difference. But we tend to use this shorthand language in a common conversation about talent, saying, oh, that basketball player is really talented, or that musician is really talented. And it may be true that in both of those cases, they are talented based on my definition. In other words, that they both had innate ability and then they honed it
right.
through their experience or through their education in ways that made a difference. But maybe not.
Yeah.
The point is that most people think of it as primarily leaning towards the innate side, not towards the applied side. And what we know is that increasingly what you develop, how you apply it, is what's going to matter in this knowledge economy.
Yeah, we were just talking about this before the podcast started, that, you know, my wife, who teaches comedy, always gets this thing of like, well, you can't, you know, teach anyone comedy. And she's like, well, I can't make someone who's not funny funny, but I can make them funnier. And I was sort of saying to you that this, it's kind of ridiculous to think that somehow that's different from a basketball player or a ballerina or, you know, anyone that if you've got a certain level of critical skills in an area, and then you have the body for it, right? You know, so if you're not going to be a basketball player if you're 5'2".
Right.
You know,
right.
But you got a really good chance if you're 7'2", and you've been able to hone the skill and that sort of thing. You have a great quote in the book. Talent has a complicated personality. It is by turns contentious, reflective, and engaged with others. So I like how you place it not alone.
Exactly. The point about talent here is that it's not something that ends up staying inside you. It's something that you develop and that, therefore, others experience your talent.
Hmm.
And that may come through your work, which is often the easiest way for us to express this. But, you know, in the changing nature of the world that we live in the increasingly complex society that we live in, being able to continually develop and hone and refine that talent is going to become important. And, you know, one of the biggest issues I think we face in this country right now is that we tend to see education as a sort of point-in-time process.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's something that you do and then you're done with it. And then you go on and you work and you live, et cetera. But it's becoming increasingly clear that what you're going to have to do is continue to refine and upgrade and hone your talent over the course of a lifetime. And people are using the same language or saying, well, it's lifelong education, lifelong learning. It's more than that. It's really about combining certainly the way in which you apply yourself through these formal learning experiences, but it's combining all of the things that you're experiencing in your life. And
right.
when you pull those things together, then you have the net result that's actually going to improve who you are and improve who we are as a society.
So you say in the book, quote, the old formula, the one that helped make the American century, doesn't quite add up anymore. So we're at risk, right?
We're at real risk, and I think a part of that is what I was talking about in terms of the fact that we tend to see this point-in-time approach to education. We're also at risk because I think that we've increasingly talked about education as a private benefit, as
mm-hmm.
something that individuals are overwhelmingly the beneficiaries, and as a result, we've disinvested or at best underinvested in the education of others. You can see this at all levels, whether it's federal estate investment in learning or whether it is in the ways in which people invest in their own learning. And the reality is that the societal benefits are growing,
mm-hmm.
right? So productivity increases, our democracy benefits because people who have a college degree vote more, they participate less in social programs, et cetera. And yet, we fundamentally have lost that public benefit argument of higher education, I fear. And I think a lot of people talk about this whole post-high school learning arena as something where, well, if you just do this much, just get enough, then you'll be okay. Then you'll get that job and then your life will change. And I don't think that's the case anymore. So I'm all in favor of the push right now for apprenticeships and sort of increasing focus on career education. But let's be clear, that's going to be short term, and those people are going to continue to have to work their way through the system, not just for their jobs, but for the betterment of their lives.
So the book proposes you've got sort of a five idea plan. That all needs to work together for this.
Every book needs to have three or five ideas.
Mine had seven.
Yes, go ahead.
I went a little fat on that, and we can't cover all of them. But one that we have to talk about because it's so important right now, and it's part of our national conversation, is what's going on around immigration. And I thought, like, your approach to this is so practical. I don't understand how someone on the right and someone on the left couldn't agree, but clearly they're not going to, because that's the world we live in right now. But talk to us why would you include immigration in a book about talent?
Look, the American story, the story of our country, is a story of immigrants. We all know what the origins of the nation are. But we also know the contemporary story. And the contemporary story is that there's a disproportionate number of immigrants who are entrepreneurs, who are people who are sort of leaders in our civic lives, the Madeleine Albrights of the world, people like that. So we know that immigration is key to the American story. My view is that we need to treat immigration as a sort of a balancing part of our talent paradigm. In other words, we should continue, obviously, to develop and grow our own talent.
Yeah.
But immigration adds tremendous value to it. It brings new ideas, new perspectives, new opportunities to our country. And to treat immigration as a problem for our country rather than as adding value, I think, is really an un-American idea. And
yeah,
I state that pretty directly, because I think that if we turn our backs on the opportunities that come to us from people around the world, and I don't just mean people with high-end skills. I mean people at the high end, the middle, and the low end, people who bring a variety of experiences. We're turning our backs on our own future. The evidence is pretty clear that immigrants, by and large, don't take the jobs of people who were born here, though that is a part of the political debate.
Yep.
The evidence is also clear that immigrants in the United States tend to assimilate pretty quickly and contribute pretty rapidly. But again, the key is that we've got to treat all immigrants, whether they're people who are coming with low skills or high skills, and give them opportunities to help advance the American story. And, I think that I'm very troubled by not only the polarized nature of the conversation, but by the mean-spiritedness and the vulgar nature of the conversation right now, that this idea of otherness, that this idea that not being one of us, whatever that means, is somehow wrong. And I think it's absolutely the opposite, and we've got to find common ground. I continue to think that these young people, these DACA recipients, half a million strong people who are in limbo right now, are sort of the tip of the spear of the opportunity here.
Yeah.
These are individuals who, in every sense, are American except for their legal status.
Mm-hmm.
And giving them the opportunity to come out of the shadows and actually show that they can contribute, I think, could be a step forward if we can get past the incendiary rhetoric that we're dealing with right now.
Yeah, and I want to highlight, too, this idea that, yes, we want to bring in the entrepreneurs, the doctors, the physicists, but we have an aging population. We are aging rapidly, and the statistics I've seen show that the in-home caregivers is overwhelmingly immigrant population.
That's right.
So we need those workers as well. There's jobs that are not being filled, and so you kind of call for this, like, yeah, immigration reform, and recognize that we want to bring in the people who are going to help the country. That feels to me like something that should bridge, any party.
It's a talent strategy.
Yeah.
You know, it's simply put that it's a part of how we enhance, how we augment the talent that's already here. And to fill in for some of those gaps, and you pointed out an important one, which is the aging nature of our population. It's also true that in the economy that we are in, where there's a real sort of a disparate nature of where success is happening, that only focusing on the high end would be a big mistake, right?
Yeah.
Only bringing in people to fill jobs that we can't fill in Silicon Valley would be a big mistake. We actually do need people to come in on the low end, but then give them the pathway up
right.
through our education and training system so that they can contribute in meaningful ways. And you know, I'm worried that the more we delay this conversation, the more we dig the hole that we're going to have to get out of later.
Yep.
And the more other countries are going to take advantage of this. You know, one of the things I point out in the book is that no other country has a model we should adopt. I just don't believe in that. I don't believe you should adopt what somebody else has done. But you should learn what others have done and mm-hmm. then adapt it to your own circumstances. The Canadians and the Australians have both done pretty well with this idea
yeah.
that you can have a talent-based immigration model, that you can still focus on the things that we cherish in the American model, which is family unification, but at the same time see talent opportunities and make sure that you're being deliberate and thoughtful about bringing people into the country to meet current and future talent needs.
Australia, ironic place to be getting this right.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
What have they done? What have they done to make it
yeah,
work?
Yeah, so the Australian model, which is the focus of what I talk about in the book, is really interesting. So they have a very deliberate strategy. You know, they sort of they work with industry, with social sector leaders. And government,
mm-hmm.
and they figure out sort of what the current needs are and what the prospective needs are. And then they develop – it's not just a sort of entry strategy. It's a recruitment strategy.
Yeah, ZipRecruiter for immigration.
They actually bring people in
yeah.
in these categories for these reasons. And again, it's not all on the high end, and I think that's really important. Now, some Australians will say that the Australian model has some unique features because it's a relatively low population country, right? So Australia's got fewer people than California does. So,
huh.
so you know, in that sense, it is a simpler model, and I get that. But we should learn some things from that model.
Yeah.
And there have been lots of bipartisan proposals in the last decade where these conversations have happened. But it's a very challenging conversation. You know, I'll just tell you one quick story, which is that in 2007 – I testified before Congress, the House Judiciary Committee, about the DREAM Act, which was being actively considered then under then President Bush, and we were tantalizingly close to getting that through. And then these same sort of nativist forces that we're seeing now emerged and fought it back, and we've wasted a decade of opportunity. We were very close to having it at that point. It was a reasonable conversation 10 years ago that then at the 11th hour the people who are advancing a negative agenda for the country won out. But I can't believe here we are in 2018, and not only are we not any closer, we may be further away.
Yeah. It's terrible. I want to talk about some of your ideas inside how we address higher education. And in particular, we just – our last interview we did was with an academic from London, Colin Fisher, who studied improvisation inside organizations. He's a jazz musician. So he comes at a lot – we talked a lot about timing.
Right.
And I'm particularly interested in that from a comic point of view because timing is everything. You talk about timing with inside education. And you say, quote, "We must make learning, not time, the key measure of progress towards a post-secondary credential." So my wife is a college professor. I read this out loud to her. She's like, yes, but explain it, because I don't think people understand how this is such a backwards thing that we do in terms of using that time measurement rather than like learning outcomes, right?
It's a really curious thing. So the way – think about just getting a college degree today in most colleges and universities. It means that you have to accumulate 120 credit hours.
Yep.
In order to get your bachelor's degree. Well, what is a credit hour? It's a unit of time, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is essentially a measure of the number of hours that you were in classroom and that you have applied instruction, et cetera, and you accumulate enough of them and you meet the other academic requirements of the institution and you get the degree. So in the current model, time is the constant and learning is the variable, right? Where you go to school, what you might the quality of that school, who you might actually have as a professor, all those things, those are all variables in the system. In the model that I'm talking about, which has a name that probably needs to be improved because it's a name that's used mostly by educators, it's called competency-based learning. Mm-hmm. What you're essentially doing is saying, look, let's make learning the constant and time the variable.
Right.
And in that model, what you essentially say is, in order to get this credential, this degree or whatever it may be, you need to know and be able to do these things. And if you know and can do these things, we will award you the credential. And this is not a theoretical idea. It actually exists. There are actually 80 colleges and universities that are doing this today in the United States in varying degrees. Some are doing it wholly. Some are doing it as a part of their program. And in this model, it is very rigorous. I've seen several of these things at work. So one of the concerns, I think, is that people think that a competency-based learning model means that you're learning very technical, sort of vocational things. These are things like you should be able to construct an argument using a global example and articulate it to an audience that is an audience you are not familiar with. Like that would be a description of a competency.
Yeah.
In order to be able to do that, you've got to have actually studied some things mm-hmm. that are reflective
and practice some stuff.
Right. Practice some stuff. Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's really what competency-based learning is all about. And the truth is that when you look at what we need as a society, whether it is the social part of what we need from people with these credentials, their contribution to our society broadly, or what we need from an employer perspective, increasingly it is those competencies, those things that you can show what you know mm-hmm. that really make a real difference in terms of your success in life. There are complications with this. One of the complications is, and one of the biggest barriers so far has actually been public policy. The way that we award financial aid, and in fact, the way that we determine tuition is largely based on this credit hour concept, right? Yeah. So the credit hours become the sort of deus ex machina of the whole learning system. So we've got to figure out how do you charge, well, what's the price, right? How do you figure out what the price is? And how do you figure out how you award financial aid to people if time is not the unit? And that's being developed. That's been an inhibitor. But I think we're working our way through that. And I see this as perhaps the most important innovation that we are looking at in post-secondary learning today. I don't see any other alternative. I think in the current model, back to our prior conversation, the current model is too expensive. Mm-hmm. And it also takes too long for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And we're not going to be able to sustain that. So in a lot of these competency-based learning models, they actually test you for the competencies before you start.
Hmm.
And so you might have some of these already. You might come in the door and already know and be able to do some of these things.
So
that makes sense.
There's two things that made me think about this. Sheldon Patinkin, who is one of the early Second City folks and was a legendary director and teacher here in town, he went to the University of Chicago, and he was a child prodigy. And at that time, so this is the 50s, basically there were classes, but if you could just come in and pass the test, you didn't need to go to any class. And he could pass the test. He was that smart. So he spent his time doing other things like hang out with Mike Nichols and Elaine May and figuring out all the Second City stuff, the theater stuff, because he was interested in that. He already had that sort of knowledge, and then he could also do other kinds of study. And then my own experience, when I went to Lake Forest College, I got spotted early, and they had an independent scholar program. It was a self-designed major. I maybe took one or two in-class classes in the semester. The rest were meetings with smart professors who gave me assignments. Usually it would be reading books and coming back and drinking coffee and talking about them, and then a project, and then I'd have to go deliver something. And then the way I graduated was by writing a thesis.
Right.
And it was incredible for me because it gave me – and I think about my career at Second City. I started as a dishwasher, but – you know, I think the reason I was able to sort of move up inside the organization was that I had all the skills building in doing it myself, in critical thinking, in needing to piece it together. It was like an education in like how to live well. So my college experience, of course, was incredibly powerful and important to me. And I can see, though, for others who go to, you know, maybe not great schools that are all time-based with teachers who aren't great, that you have the opposite.
Yeah.
It's you know, I guess you can call it broken, but that doesn't mean you need to throw it out, because we can't do that.
No, clearly there's too much capacity there, and there's too much knowledge. You know, I think the other element of this is that it's what society needs, right?
Yeah.
The fact is that this is what we need people to do, and I've heard another criticism of this, which is that well, what we're going to do is end up just turning all learning into being able to complete a test. Most of these schools really have pushed back on this. Most of what you need to do to demonstrate the competency mm-hmm. is that you have to have a portfolio, you have to
right.
do a demonstration that you have to have. So not at all test-based, because a lot of these competencies you really can't test
yeah.
through some sort of multiple choice options. It just doesn't work that way.
Right, and I think this idea of a diversity of presentation is really smart
yes.
Because the world we're moving to is one that is not that straightforward, right? You know, sometimes it's visual, sometimes it's auditory. You know, you've got to be able to work well in groups of two and groups of 2,000. So giving someone a chance to like experiment and play around with that stuff. I mean, my kids all went to Chicago Waldorf. So, you know, there's not textbooks. They make their textbooks. And what's funny, too, because they have to do things like sew. So when Nick got to Skidmore and someone had a problem in the, you know, with a costume, he's like, here, I'll take it. And like, you sew? And he's like, yeah, useful skill, you know, and applied it right away. I jotted down a bunch of lines because I love so much of the book. And one of the things you said was, quote, we have not focused enough on collaboration over competition. Talk to us about that. I'm a big fan of collaboration.
Yeah, I really think that you know, what we know about how people learn and how success really happens is that success is never the genius insight of somebody who has thought through the entire problem. What they've figured out is one piece of this. And then
yes.
working with others, they come together and they actually create the solution together. And so this is the bring a brick idea that has been such an important part of the Second City experience. But I also think that it's reality. We live in a complex society,
mm-hmm.
and the idea that someone is going to develop the concept, prototype it, test it, and take it to conclusion is just sort of crazy. You need lots of actors collaborating,
yeah.
Collaborators that are actually have good intent, that they actually want
mm-hmm.
a good outcome is really important. The problem with the learning system is that it is a highly competitive system. So one of the biggest issues we face right now is that there is a rising demand for talent, and so there is a competition for students and dollars.
Yeah.
And so that competition really plays out in some pretty ugly ways, and particularly for the places that are competitive, which is a relatively small part of the equation, they're willing to spend a lot of money and do a lot of things that are pretty uncomfortable in order to get the students. And I just think it's counterproductive. I think that we need to figure out a different model where collaboration helps us educate and train a much larger number of people, literally helping them to do more and better.
This is a great quote. Being a member of Mensa requires an IQ above 132, but what has Mensa ever done of note? I Googled this. Mensa's never done anything of note. Yeah. Wouldn't you think if you got all these geniuses in there, they'd be figuring stuff out and it would be all over the internet?
I'm with you. It's fascinating.
I mean, I don't want to take down Mensa on the podcast, but we might have to.
I don't understand it. It's some sort of badge of honor for somebody.
But what
not
have
sure
they
what
done?
To demonstrate. Right?
They've done nothing.
Exactly. Show what you know. Right.
And right.
What's your competency?
Right. This is good. In general, workers value thinking more than doing in our economy. That's a little bit different.
Yeah, I think that part of the issue is, you know, we sort of learned this from the Japanese, right? The total quality management idea, which is mm-hmm. that the doing part, first of all, is really can become very redundant and difficult. But the thinking part, the being a part of the solution and working your way through the problems of a job, whether it's a job that has a lot of guardrails, like accounting, or it's a job that doesn't, you know, like being a stand-up comedian.
Mm-hmm.
You really have to think a lot more than do. And doing in the world where AI and automation are becoming sort of an important part of how work gets done is going to be less and less important than thinking, right? Because, you know, this is part of what I've been thinking about lately, which is what is human work in the 21st century? What are humans doing that the robots won't be able to do? And that sounds scary to people, but I think it's motivating, it's liberating in some ways to think about the fact that as human, we have these unique capacities that we have to develop and hone. But we have these capacities that we should be able to use and express in work in the 21st century. But that's going to require thinking, not just doing these repetitive tasks or performing these functions.
We had a business call with one of the guys working on Watson at IBM.
Yeah.
And they were, because we'd heard they were teaching Watson comedy. And they're like, yeah, he can tell a joke. You know, it's not a great joke. And we go, and this guy knows a little bit about improvisation. I go, Watson improvise? He goes, robots are terrible improvisers.
Right.
They can't do it. Because so much around improvisation, and frankly, original comedy, is incongruity and, you know, upsetting patterns. And that's the one thing that they've got that they can do faster than anything is establish these patterns. But when you break them apart, that's not their skill set. So ideas of, you know, critical thinking, creativity, innovation, all the stuff that someone's making fun of the philosophy major, you know, for, is actually the stuff that's probably going to be really, really useful.
Exactly. I say hang on to your philosophy credential because I think you're going to be in real demand in the future labor market. And I do think that this is another problem that I think we have with the way that we've marketed higher education today is that we equate the major with a job, right? So what does a philosophy major do? Be a philosopher? No, of course not. A philosophy major has all of these talents and skills that they can apply in different contexts. And what we know about philosophy majors, or my favorite example, English majors, is that they actually have this ability to express themselves and articulate in ways that are really important and valuable. And so there's a disproportionate number of English majors in the financial services field, which you would think, why would that be? Well, it's because there's lots of people who can do the numbers side, but the people who can actually figure out what are the new products, what are the new services, how do you do customer service, all those things, those are the English majors.
Yeah, what's the story? Who can tell the story?
Right?
Yeah, yeah. All right, I'm going to ask you in a second for your yes and story, but before I do that, I want to give a shout out to libraries. We had Brian Bannon on here from the Chicago Public Library System, and when I had to do research into what they do, I was like, oh man, the innovation going on at libraries is just stunning. And you say in the book, quote, libraries have always been on the cutting edge of change. I don't think people know that.
Yeah, I think that we tend to see libraries as repositories rather than as places where real learning is taking place. And and certainly libraries play an important sort of function of serving as a place where stuff gets kept, much as museums are. But the fact is that libraries have always been places where people expand their knowledge, where they learn and apply themselves, as they do, by the way, in other cultural institutions like museums. And I think it is an opportunity that we have. One of the points that I make in the book is that we should see libraries and museums and sort of old line cultural institutions as a part of this learning infrastructure in the 21st century. You know, a lot of what they do looks a lot like an educational institution, except they don't award credentials. And we should ask ourselves the question, why is that?
Right.
Why shouldn't you be able to, through a museum or a library, actually be able to get a credential at the end because of what you've gotten out of that experience? And the New York Public Library is experimenting with some of these ideas, but there are lots of opportunities, I think, to not just see the future of learning as tech, but to see the future of learning as being experienced in lots of different contexts.
Yeah. I mean, the Chicago Public Library, too. The Makers Lab they created there, that where Chance the Rapper did his stuff.
Right.
I mean, that would help solve your time issue, too, because there's so, you know, people are going to libraries after school or, you know, on weekends or whatever. I mean, that experience, that's a learning experience that goes to it.
Yeah.
All right. We could talk all day. However, I do want to ask you to close out if you have a yes and story. So we always end the podcast with this. The idea in improv is that you can't get anything done when you say no, and you can't say yes, but you have to say yes and. So I'm wondering, in your work or life, do you have a yes and story?
I do. So in 2007, I was running an organization called the Institute for Higher Education Policy, a think tank in D.C. I got a phone call from a recruiter asking me about this organization called the Lumina Foundation. Mm-hmm. And I knew the Lumina Foundation very well, so I started giving him all these ideas about people who could be their next CEO. And at the end of the call, he says, you know, actually, I think they should talk to you. And I said, No. No, I'm not interested. You know, I loved what I did and had gotten calls from recruiters for years. I went home that night and I talked to my wife, and my wife, who is a very straight shooting South Side of Chicago girl, said to me, "Don't be an idiot. If you don't do this, you'll always wonder whether you could actually make a real difference." And the yes and part of that, I think, is that I said, yes, and I want to not just be a good grant-making organization. I want to be an organization that's actually a leadership organization. Mm-hmm. I want to actually contribute as Lumina Foundation to the advancement and scaling of the best new ideas, not just as an organization that's making grants to others that have good ideas, but participate in that. And I've been extremely fortunate to do this for the last decade, and I'm very happy that I did.
And part of that yes and is you listen to your wife.
Yes, well, without a doubt, without a doubt. And I continue to do so.
JB, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Kevin.